Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the remarkable discovery in brain science that could help explain Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, and many other illnesses. We'll spend this hour with journalist Donna Jackson Nakazawa talking about microglia, tiny cells that were long believed to have one job, robotically removing dead cells as a kind of cleanup crew for our gray matter. Research in the past few years has revealed microglia are a lot more like an immune system for the brain, actively searching for damaged cells and synapses. But like the immune system in the rest of the body, microglia sometimes get it wrong and turn against the brains they're supposed to protect. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
It's kind of a paradox. Lots of things that are good for us are bad for us as well. We can't live more than a few days without water, but too much can drown us in a matter of minutes. Antibiotics are just the thing if we're fighting a bacterial infection, but overuse actually helps the bugs evolve resistance. And within our own bodies, our immune systems can protect us, or they can turn on us in the form of autoimmune disorders like psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus. Could brain diseases also be caused by a defense system gone bad? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Donna Jackson Nakazawa is a writer and speaker focused on neuroscience, immunology, and human emotion. As it happens, she has suffered from two deeply disabling bouts of Guillain-Barré syndrome that left her partially paralyzed for many long months. That disease is understood to be about the body. But as she recovered, she also noticed mental symptoms, a sudden inability to call to mind common words, a deep, persistent depression that felt bigger than just a response to her physical challenges. As it happens, she became ill just a few years before scientists made an astonishing discovery that has upended neuroscience. Just like the body, the brain has a kind of immune system that normally cleans out dead or disused cells and synapses. But as in the rest of the body, the brain's immune system may sometimes suddenly shift into overdrive and create rather than repair damage. Jackson Nakazawa explains the implications of this discovery in her book, The Angel and the Assassin, the tiny brain cell that changed the course of medicine. Donna, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us more about these cognitive effects that you experienced when you were recovering from Guillain-Barré syndrome last time. What told you this was something different than just being upset that you weren't completely well or absent-minded or whatever?
Well, I found the cognitive changes more of a clue than the emotional ones, to be honest, because, of course, it's very depressing and anxiety-provoking to be paralyzed and away from your kids and in the hospital for a month and then raising them more or less from bed. So that makes sense. That's anxious making. Who would be happy about that? It's terribly difficult. It's a lot of adversity. But the cognitive changes just went against everything that I'd experienced in my life. You know, I'd be staring at my daughter's shoes and struggling to remember how to tie them. I remember thinking, you know, bunny loops, Donna, go back to bunny loops. My son would bring me simple grade school kitchen math, and I'd think, okay, that's a 9 and that's a 7. And together, it just really felt so far afield from who I was, you know, just as my body did not feel like my own, my brain did not feel like my own. So it just started me on a journey of trying to figure out how was having an autoimmune disorder changing my brain function. And at that time, no one knew.
Yeah. What did your doctors say when you told them about these things you were experiencing?
Well, I'm really blessed in that I have a top team at Johns Hopkins. I live here in Baltimore. And so shout out to them. They saved my life more times than I can count. But at the time, the literature held that it was categorically impossible that the brain was connecting to what was happening in terms of inflammation or autoimmunity in the body. And that was just a really well-accepted thing. You read it in every study. The brain is categorically immune privileged, is how scientists refer to it. So, you know, I would talk with them and they would say, it just makes a lot of sense that you would be having a hard time right now. This is a difficult disease. It's very physically painful. And that's altering your experience. But I'm a science journalist. I've written 6 books. So I started keeping this little file. I was writing another book at that time about autoimmune disease, the autoimmune epidemic. And I kept this little file on the side of my desk, which I called Brain Flame, because that's how it felt to me. I remember reading Harry Potter with my son from bed and the Dementors came in. Do you remember those? And I thought, oh my God, these ghoul shape-shifting creatures that float above you and steal your good and happy thoughts, but also your sense of who you are and your ability to function in the world. It felt like that was happening to me. So I started my little Brain Flame file, and I started putting every study I came across in it that showed any link between inflammation and or autoimmune disease and cognitive changes, depression, mood disorders, even psychosis. And what I found was pretty astonishing.
There have been studies that show that people with certain autoimmune disorders are highly susceptible to brain diseases and decline. Is that right?
Well, they all came about really in the latter part, really from about 2010 on. A few studies in 2008, but just to mention a few of them that went in my Brain Flame file, patients who had had a bacterial infection that was so serious they were hospitalized were much more likely to later be diagnosed with depression or bipolar disorder. Well, if the brain and body aren't talking, why would that be? Patients with MS or lupus or rheumatoid arthritis have a significantly higher rate of reporting cognitive decline, being diagnosed with depression or, again, mood disorders. And there were a couple of case studies on schizophrenia that really had me scratching my head. In one study, a patient received a bone marrow transplant from his brother who had schizophrenia, and he developed schizophrenia several weeks later. That just made no sense. Your bone marrow is where your immune cells are born and go out to fight against any incoming infection or threat. And in another case study, a patient with schizophrenia who received a bone marrow transplant had his schizophrenia symptoms improve dramatically. So how could that be if the body and brain function as separate entities? And again, that led me to ask, you know, how are our body and brain talking and what are they talking about?
Why would scientists have thought the brain didn't seem to need immune system protection during the many decades when they assumed that the brain was, as you mentioned, immune privileged?
Well, we have two schools of thought to thank for that. One is early philosophers. And, you know, from the era of Descartes, he put forth this idea that body and brain weren't connected, what we think of in philosophy as mind-body dualism. And that really came down through academic institutions for 300 years, this idea that the body and brain function as church and state entities. But we also had good anatomical reasons for thinking that the body and brain didn't talk to each other. And it's really a study in contrast between what we thought we knew then, as with all major medical discoveries, what we thought we knew then contrasts dramatically with what we know now. So three of those are microglia were noted and named in the 1920s, these little immune cells in the brain, and they were miscategorized. They were thought to descend from nerve cells during the time when all of our cells in utero begin to differentiate and some become, you know, nerve cells and some become immune cells and some become your skin and your hair. So they were misunderstood. They were thought to be these very boring little helper cells that went and cleaned up neurons and catered to the needs of neurons the way that movie stars might cater, an entourage might cater to the needs of a movie star. Neurons were the flashy darling of the research world, and we just missed what microglia were doing. We missed that they were immune cells. And later it became clear, and this isn't until 2011, that microglia were actually descending from immune cells during gestation in the womb when cells differentiate from stem cells into different types of cells. They were breaking off from white blood cells, rising up to the brain, and governing the brain's immune health throughout our lives. The second thing we missed is that we thought that the brain wouldn't have an immune system of its own that could function in the way the immune system functions in the body, because in the body, if you have an injury, it gets red hot, painful, and swollen, right? Well, how would that happen? Every time you had inflammation in the brain has this hard top, the skull. It just can't swell whenever there's an inflammatory trigger, or, you know, we would be drilling into the skull all the time. So another piece of anatomy which led us to think that the brain would be immune privileged, and probably the biggest one of all is the blood-brain barrier, which is this dense constellation of red blood cells at the base of the brain. And it's so tightly packed that it doesn't let immune molecules rise up from the body into the brain. And so it was thought that, you know, the brain was just living an entirely different world than the body in terms of immune function. And what we didn't really understand was that immune molecules don't need to get up through that blood-brain barrier into the brain, because our white blood cells in our body, their cousins, these little cells called microglia, are already in the brain policing the neighborhood.
All right, I want to step back for just a minute. Many people know that the very young brains form all kinds of synapses, which are like connections between neurons, right? Why does the developing brain prune away unnecessary or unused synapses?
Well, it's a great question. And that is because if we just kept, if the brain just kept creating more and more synaptic connections between neurons, it would be like a tree that just grows so many branches. Eventually it would fall, it wouldn't be able to function. So imagine that there's so many connections that the brain isn't even able to communicate clearly between important areas of the brain, like the alert center, the amygdala, or the prefrontal cortex, where we make some of our good and bad decisions. So then the connectome of the brain has to be just right. It has to have healthy, robust synaptic connections, but not so many that the airwaves aren't clear.
So this neuroscientist, who is a main character in this book named Beth Stevens, started wondering, what if this pruning process went wrong? How did it occur to her that that might even happen?
Well, you know, Beth was amazing. And I think, you know, there's a shout out here for young women in science, because I think young women in science have to break things a lot in order to make their careers happen, and women, you know, in many different fields to be taken seriously. And I think that a lot of the researchers in the book are women because they weren't afraid to ask questions other people weren't asking, because they'd already learned to kind of break things down to get where they were. So so Beth had been working in a lab, Beth Stevens at Stanford, and she was working with really the scientific father of microglial research, Ben Barres, who actually was born Barbara Barres, also had to break down a lot of barriers and to ask a lot of questions other researchers weren't asking. And in that lab, they had been looking at how synapses that were marked with a particular type of molecule called complement were disappearing. And at the same time, tools were becoming available that allowed researchers to look at the brain in high-resolution pictures under high-resolution microscopes. And Beth had seen a fellow researcher show her some of these images of microglia that he had been taking. And they were wildly active. These cells, and the first time I sat in her lab and I saw them, they're like swirling through the brain. It reminded me of Van Gogh's Starry Night. They are not these boring robot cells that just come in and, you know, give sips of growth factors to neurons. And that made her question, could microglia be playing some role in pruning these synapses in good and bad ways?
All right. My guest is Donna Jackson Nakazawa. We're talking about her book, The Angel and the Assassin, the tiny brain cell that changed the course of medicine. We'll be right back. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Donna Jackson Nakazawa. We're talking about her latest book, The Angel and the Assassin, the tiny brain cell that changed the course of medicine. So, Donna, you were describing these very active cells moving through the brain. How do microglia find damaged brain cells and synapses to remove when everything is working properly?
Well, if everything is working properly, then as we said earlier, some of these synapses have to be pruned for healthy brain development. And so they might go over and prune away at some synaptic connections that aren't being used a lot, right? Like we all know that idea of neuroplasticity where, you know, if you don't practice the piano over time, your brain will change in such a way that it's going to be harder for you to go back and play the song you played 20 years ago. If you're practicing as a ballerina and you're trying to do a pirouette on one toe and you do that over time, you'll develop new synapses in the brain. The brain will literally change based on what we use and don't use. So in a healthy developing brain, microglia are going to take those unused synapses that get marked by this molecule complement, and they're going to go over there and they're going to morph from these elegant dancer-like cells with these long, beautiful limbs that kind of dance through the brain and become these kind of big, bushy, dark Pac-Man-like cells, if your listeners are old enough to know what Pac-Man are. And they're going to start chomping on those unused synapses. But the problem happens and comes in when microglia start to get overwhelmed and over-triggered by the same triggers that overtax our immune system in our body, and they begin to attack healthy and needed and necessary synapses and those connections that we need that give us our mental stamina or clarity of mind or make us feel hopeful or joyful. So they, well, hence the title of the book, right? They're the angels of the brain, where they can calm the brain and behave it when they behave as nature intended. They're doing all the good work of the brain. They're the good doctors of the brain. But when they are overwhelmed, they become overactive and they become the brain's kind of blind assassins.
And if they become overactive and take away too many synapses, suddenly parts of the brain may no longer be able to communicate well. Talk about the kinds of symptoms and the kinds of diseases we'll have heard of that might, in fact, be caused, at least in part, by this effect.
Right. So I want to be clear that, you know, we know that microglia snip synapses when they're triggered. They morph into these Pac-Man-like cells. And they take out healthy needed synapses. They also spit out neurotoxins, which lead to a kind of inflammation in the brain that is not red hot, painful, swollen. It's just this sort of toxic spewing out of inflammatory factors that cause synapses to be impaired. And we see this in Alzheimer's disease. And it is thought to also be part of what's happening in neuropsychiatric disease. So the question right now is, are microglia the primary driver of psychiatric disease, or are they a secondary driver? Because a lot of the different chemicals that we associate with brain health, including dopamine and serotonin and glutamate, are expressed through these tiny little cells. So we know they play some role, whether causal or contributing, to Alzheimer's, neuropsychiatric disorders like depression, anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia, Neurological disorders like, Parkinson's and Huntington's and multiple sclerosis. So really a wide range of different disorders, from things that we think of as small cognitive changes to the big kahuna, like Alzheimer's disease.
So, Donna, many people will have heard, if not personally experienced, the fact that common medications for illnesses like major depression seem to work a lot better for some patients than others. How might these discoveries about the mechanisms of microglia run amok explain that effect?
Oh, I love this question. So we theorize that in patients for whom antidepressants are working well, part of the reason is that it leads to something called neurogenesis, and that is the birth of new neurons, which become healthy and help populate the hippocampus. But when that neurogenesis isn't happening, we begin to see the synaptic loss in the brain that you can see through brain scans, right? You can see that certain areas of the brain are not connecting the way they need to for good communication and healthy mind states. So when that's the case, it appears to be that microglia are taking out more synapses than they ought to, but they're also spitting out these neurotoxins, which lead to shifts in these chemicals that we associate with healthy brain function. And when this goes on for too long, it leads to something that we think of and researchers call runaway microglial neuroinflammation. So to step back, if antidepressants work in one patient, they may be working because they are allowing neurogenesis to happen, which also means they're causing microglia to back off, right? Hmm. And microglia, bad microglia back off, good microglia are able to produce more of the chemicals in the way that they're supposed to. These chemicals are expressed through microglia, and that allows neurogenesis to happen. But when we don't see them work, what we call treatment-resistant depression and bipolar disease, theoretically, researchers believe this is because that inflammation, that neuroinflammation that's occurred because of microglia, has been set in place in such a way that it's more difficult to right the brain. And that's leading to a lot of new areas of research, which I think are pretty exciting.
Is there any good reason microglia activity might sometimes cause depression-like symptoms when someone is actually physically ill?
Yeah, so I write a whole chapter about this, and it is so fascinating. Of course, I'm a nerd, I'm a science journalist, so I just love this kind of interconnection between how we evolved across evolutionary time and how our brain learned to respond to the world around us. So across evolutionary time, we evolved in such a way that when there were a lot of perceived threats in our environment, it upped our stress immune response and our cytokines, which are immune molecules, which we associate with neuroinflammation. And that really made sense because across evolutionary time, if you were under a lot of perceived stress and social threats, those were going to lead to you being ostracized and set outside the tribe. Hmm. If you're set outside the tribe, that's really dangerous for your immune system. You have no protection. You're more likely to find yourself facing warring tribes, which would lead to injury and infection and pathogens. You're more likely to be at the mercy of predators, predatory animals, which would also lead to wounding and infection. So over millions of years, we evolved in such a way that when we see a lot of social threat or there are a lot of perceived threats, and in fact, we're all living through that right now, right? There are a lot of perceived threats in our environment. That causes our immune response to up and get busy as if we're going to have a physical wound. And researchers really can't see a difference between the brain responding to threats, emotional threats, whether they're on social media or you're scrolling through Twitter, and how the brain responds to that in terms of upping the immune system in ways that over time can become negative, and actually having a pathogenic hit. So over time, perceived stress, which leads to this big uptick in your stress immune response, goes from being a positive defense in the short term, it's positive, into a negative defense, which just overwhelms your immune system and actually makes you more susceptible to inflammatory disorders, including depression.
All right, we have an email here from Daryl who wants to know if there's a correlation between brain inflammation and C-reactive proteins in blood tests. Yes. For example, brain and body inflammation track with each other?
Yeah, so there's a really cool study going on right now at Mayo Clinic, which is just wrapping up, and I just reported on this for STAT. And they are actually looking at treatment-resistant depression and bipolar, which we talked about just a minute ago. And they're looking at different biomarkers that they can use to predict which patients are going to have high inflammation and then use therapeutics, in this case, ketamine, to treat those patients and see if their prediction based on C-reactive protein and IL-6, interleukin, are good biomarkers to say, hey, we think if we have this level of physical inflammation, right, in the body, which C-reactive protein helps to measure, and so does IL-6, we think that's a good predictor because of the way that body and brain are talking all the time. They're cross-talking through the brain's immune system and the body's immune system. That would be a good predictor, right, that somebody would have treatment-resistant depression or bipolar. And because some therapeutics like ketamine, and there are many others being studied now, are good anti-inflammatories, it would make sense that somebody with high C-reactive protein would be more likely to respond to ketamine treatment. And so that's really exciting research. And it also extends out into some other therapeutics that are long been used in autoimmune disease. Actually, some of them are being used in COVID-19 right now, and are looking to have possibly a good effect on depression and bipolar. But we need to do a lot more studies in that area, because one thing every science reporter knows is that you get all excited about something, and then 3 years later, you realize that it's also doing some harm. So we have to go carefully with these therapeutics.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Donna, do microglia as a possible cause of brain disease help explain why certain illnesses seem to set in for people at particular life stages? We hear about depression often beginning in early adolescence or schizophrenia in early adulthood. Is there sort of a time that passes before enough damage has been done for people to notice symptoms?
Yeah, so we know that depression, when we see signs of it, it is years later from when that first overpruning or inflammation started to be set in place. In fact, the work going on in Alzheimer's at Broad Institute and at Harvard, which is really being led by Beth Stevens and a team of other extraordinary researchers, has found that synaptic loss occurs decades before the first symptoms of Alzheimer's. And so that's a really, really big hope, because what it means, my dog is barking in the background.
It's okay. Just to tell our listeners, lots of folks are home doing these interviews. We get it. People have dogs.
Yeah, we're just doing the best we can here, folks. So that is so hopeful, right? Because what it means is that we have the possibility, with new ways of detecting this synaptic loss, to intervene decades before a lot of inflammation occurs. And in Alzheimer's, of course, we see tau proteins build up, and we see a lot of synaptic loss and a lot of inflammation. So if we have lead time, that gives us a lot of opportunity to do a lot of good, so that these symptoms are much less severe in the long term, or maybe don't even happen at all.
What might microglia and these discoveries about their autoimmune challenges, what might that have to do with rising overall rates of mental illnesses?
Well, I think that we're living in an interesting time where we have kind of outpaced our evolutionary ability to keep up with all the different ways in which we've changed the world around us. Our brain is always dancing with the universe around us in this moment by moment interactive dance where we're constantly, our brain is constantly asking, are we safe or not safe, right? And when it feels that it's not safe, it's going to send messages to our body that we're not safe. And that is going to kind of overprime microglia to get overactive. So imagine the world that we're living in right now, not just with this current virus, but, you know, our kids are in a world with school shootings and increased serious competition for college and grades and sports awards. And we have climate change, which is, you know, really scary and frightening. And we've also changed our diet in thousands of ways where people are living on a lot more processed food. We've added, 80,000 different chemicals into our environment that aren't tested in terms of how they affect the immune system in the body, much less the immune system in the brain. So if all those things are inflammatory, it would make sense if body and brain are chatting all the time and they're chatting about whether or not we're safe, that would increase our inflammatory signals, which would increase neuroinflammation and depression and anxiety and other disorders as well. And we know that we're seeing doubling and tripling rates of all of these disorders, especially in adolescence, which is a really interesting area of research.
My guest is Donna Jackson Nakazawa. She's an author and speaker focused on neuroscience, immunology, and human emotion. Her newest book is called The Angel and the Assassin, the tiny brain cell that changed the course of medicine. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Donna Jackson Nakazawa. We're talking about her new book, The Angel and the Assassin, the tiny brain cell that changed the course of medicine. Donna, medical science is learning, little by little, how to calm down an overactive immune system in the body. Can we also give new instructions to microglia that are running amok in the brain?
Well, people are doing that. You know, the field is really pivoting in that direction. Hey, you know, how can we calm down these microglia cells and help them to behave as nature intended? And they're doing that, and researchers are doing that through many different avenues. One we already touched on, which will be utilizing some of the therapeutics that are used in inflammation and autoimmune disease in the body to help treat disorders of the brain. Some of the other things that are coming down the pike, look at the brain as an electrical organ. So, our brain is an electrical organ. It's beating regularly through electrical impulses. And some fascinating work is coming out of MIT where researcher Li Wei Cai, she's been looking at the way in which microglia are caught up in producing brain waves that help us feel calm or clear of mind, and what she might be able to do by using light pulses to help shift those electrical impulses in ways that change the behavior of microglia in Alzheimer's. And that is now in clinical trials. I've been following that research really closely. I write about it in the book. It's fascinating. Now that we know that microglia are in the center of every story of all the different diseases of the brain that we give so many different names to, from ADHD to OCD to depression to schizophrenia, we can now start to look at how microglia work, both in terms of expressing neurochemicals, also in terms of how they build or sculpt synapses, but also how they work as helping to keep the electrical beat of the brain going, and what we can do by causing them to reboot electrically. So not only is this work going on at MIT, which is called gamma light flicker therapy, currently in clinical trials, but it's also causing some older therapies to get a new look, like neurofeedback, which helps to reorganize waves in the brain, the different brain waves that we associate with cognitive function and alpha state, you know, that state, meditative state. So researchers are starting to look at that. They're looking at transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is delivering electrical pulses safely from outside the brain that help to stop overactivity of synapses in some areas, and in other areas where there's underactivity of synaptic connections, help get those synaptic connections back online. And that work is going on at Harvard and Mayo and many other places. And it's looking that in some patients with treatment-resistant depression, 30 treatments of TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, will help not only resolve depression, but many of these patients never have a relapse. All of these things come with caveats, right? For instance, TMS may not be as helpful in patients with bipolar disorder. So all of these things have to be done with medical professionals, but it is opening up this broad picture of possibility and hope by just looking at all the different ways in which this cell, microglia, act as this empress of the brain.
Some doctors have suggested patients experiment with different kinds of diets. Tell us about the fasting mimicking diet and how it might help reset microglia that have gone off course.
Well, and fasting is interesting, and again, comes with a big caveat. No one wants to run out and try fasting all by themselves, you know, call your doctor. But researchers at Johns Hopkins and University of Southern California have been looking at how fasting mimicking diets, which mean a fasting mimicking diet means eating a very few calories, but those calories are nutrient dense. And fast and intermittent fasting refers to eating, say, for 8 or 10 hours during the day and then going without any food for that entire evening overnight, and then eating again, say, at 10 o'clock the next morning, eating for another 8 hour period, and then not eating for the rest of the day. So that appears, both of those appear to work in a similar way. And that is that when our body gets the signal that we're not getting food regularly all the time, it kind of, everything gets a little bit smaller. Our organs shrink down just a tiny bit. Everything shrinks down. And in that shrinking down, the body tends to do something really healthy for us. It says, okay, well, you know, we're not going to get what we want here for a little while. So we're going to shrink everything down. And we're going to boot out and kick out those cells that are less healthy. And that appears to be helpful in not only kicking out and getting rid of some of the body's immune cells that may be functioning suboptimally, but also to get rid of some of those unhealthy microglia that are shifting from a good state into an inflammatory state. And the way in which that works is really promising, because it means that there may be a way that we can combine with some therapeutics, use intermittent fasting and fasting mimicking diets along with some other therapeutics. And usually when we see patients recover, patients try lots of things safely with their doctors, and they do like a combo effect between different treatments. And by doing that, help to kick out or get rid of or flush out some of the unhealthy microglia that are associated with over-pruning the brain or attacking brain synapses. So I think that's pretty exciting.
How do microglia respond to brain injuries like concussion?
Really fascinating. I spent a lot of time with Alan Faden at Shock Trauma Maryland. He's the head of the STAR Research Center there. And Faden has been able to find that after a brain injury, microglia release inflammatory factors Some of these factors descend into the body's bloodstream, and little blood samples can be taken which actually show how inflammatory the brain is at that point in time. And that's really helpful because with any kind of brain injury or concussion, we're kind of looking at the brain as a black box, right? We don't have a good way of knowing in any given patient at any given moment, A, how serious is this concussion? Is it mild or is it moderate or is it more serious? We don't see exterior signs all the time outside of, you know, a bump on the outside of the skull for 3 days. And we also don't know how quickly is that patient recovering from that injury. So there are a lot of missteps in concussion treatment where you have patients who seemingly have a mild injury, but it turns out that it's actually causing neuroinflammation in the brain for months and even years. And here this, again, comes in this star cell microglia, which is releasing these inflammatory toxins. They descend into the bloodstream, and researchers are now being able to look at those blood samples and say, actually, this might look like a mild concussion, but it's a much more serious concussion than we thought. This person is really going to have to do a lot of different things and step back for a longer recovery period. And then it allows us to do something else. And that is that as an individual's doctor or neurologist begins to oversee their recovery period, they have a way to also look, how is the brain recovering? How are the different things that we're trying here working? People are trying moderate exercise to help with concussion. They're trying fasting diets to help with concussion and many other things. So are they working or are they not working? How quickly is a young athlete recovering? This helps us, this understanding of microglia helps us to not only diagnose concussion more accurately, but also to help oversee therapeutic recovery much more closely and accurately.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there evidence, Donna, that our genes might play a role in how susceptible we are to autoimmune brain disorders?
Yes. So everything is a gene environment dance. As I said, you know, our brain is kind of like our seventh sense. It's just dancing in this all every millisecond in this intricate dialogue with our environment. Are we safe or are we not safe? Well, those environmental signals are also dancing with our genes. And of course, many of us have inherited some genes that other people haven't. You know, autoimmune genes in my family run rampant. Pretty much everybody in my family has an autoimmune disease. So that is also the case with psychiatric disease. We certainly see families where bipolar is much more likely to occur in individuals. And that the old saying, which we don't like to use anymore, but people might recognize, is that, genes are the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. Mm-hmm. None of us like that, you know, but that is to give people a very simple idea of how genes and the environment interact. But I think there's an invitation there. It's a lovely invitation that if we know that we have these immune cells in the brain, if we know that they're overseeing our immune health in our brain, which will alter how we feel or think, we understand that we have a lot that we can do to protect our immune system in our body, right? And to help prevent that gene environment dance from occurring in negative ways in susceptible individuals, including ourselves. We're the drivers. You know, we have a lot of agency in terms of making micro changes that help to protect our immune system, both in our body and in our brain, so that those genes, that genetic susceptibility, isn't triggered. And I think that's the big message here, is that now we know these little cells are there. They are creating neuroplastic changes all the time that will change how we feel down the road. we may have genes, as I certainly do, that are make us more susceptible, but it changes the way that we see how we interact in every single way throughout our day. You know, what we're eating and how well we're taking care of ourselves and how much we're exposing ourselves to a lot of emotional stressors and the relationships that we're in and the toxins we're exposed to. And I think it's really exciting. You know, we can be more mindful of creating a healthy world for our brain.
Given that this research is so relatively new, how should patients talk to their doctors about it? If they're listening to this and thinking maybe this has something to do with how I've been feeling, but they go to their doctor and their doctor's not up on this, are there good ways to kind of introduce the topic?
I think that physicians are becoming more and more aware that the brain immune health affects how a patient is going to feel and what the trajectory of their life will look like in terms of developing depression, anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia, and Alzheimer's. So I think that general idea that brain health is immune health is getting out there. So I think that is the way to go at it, kind of big picture. Hey, look, you know, I know that my brain has an immune system the same way my body has an immune system. And just as physicians are trying to be prophylactic and help patients stay healthy with exercise and diet and mindfulness and yoga and meditation, we are also starting to have that conversation culturally and physicians as well about how to keep the brain's immune system healthy. And so when we generalize it in that way, I think it's a really easy conversation to have.
The new book by journalist Donna Jackson Nakazawa is called The Angel and the Assassin, The Tiny Brain Cell That Changed the Course of Medicine. Donna, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Such a pleasure. Such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is at K-E-R-A Think. We hope that you will sign up and subscribe for the Think podcast. It's free wherever you get your podcast. You can find it by searching for K-E-R-A Think. You can also get the podcast on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.